mind to do so again. Soon I reached the cover of an oak wood, and then a deep ravine, where I climbed carefully over some mossy rocks, using my cane to good effect. Clambering out of the ravine, I crossed over a grassy place and entered a clump of yew that covered a knoll. There, under shelter of the woods, I paused to consider my course. Undoubtedly, when the lads who attacked us had set the countryside upon us, they had told some tale of violence or theft. Many parties of horsemen and others would be scouring the country in search of us, and where we found, it would go hard. For no explanation would suffice against the accusation of one of their own. The place I had now reached was on a steep mountainside, and the yew was thick. No horseman would ride down this slope, and I doubted that any of the ruffians who attacked us would. Such folk were not apt to go where the travelling was hard, so it might be best to remain where I was for the time, and not chance the moors or grassland above until darkness fell. What I feared most was dogs. If they brought dogs to search for us, we would be found. At least, I would be. It was late afternoon, and if the next hour or two were passed in safety, I might yet go free. Below me, the land lay wide under the mouth of the ravine. Here and there were clumps of yew, then patches of oak, and below a checkerboard of fields and pastures. A lovely, peaceful land, but not for me. I was again in flight. Would there never be a place to rest? Never a place where I could stop and serve, where I could do something of worth without forever living in fear. It came to me then that I must be away from England if I wished to be free. And yet I had grown to love this land and many of its people. Why must London forever hold out to beckoning finger? What awaited me there, if anything? Had not many warned me against the hazards of that city? Slowly the shadows gathered behind me, while the valley below still lay bathed in sunlight. Here and there, I could see distant troops of horsemen wending their homeward way. Had they found my friends? The Haycocks now. How had Corey known of them? Were there many such, scattered about in unused fields or ancient pastures, places of which the gypsies knew, and to which they could resort in time of need? No doubt, I decided, there were. At last I arose. If I were to choose my way, I must be going now, before all was darkness. Slowly, I walked through the yew and emerged upon the hillside. My muscles were stiff from sitting on the damp earth, and I was tired from the running and climbing, but I knew I must get on. Over the rim of the hill I mounted, and out into the angry red of a vanished sun. Streaks of scarlet and gold-laced clouds lay in the west, and the heather moor lay about me. I stood alone upon it, as if in a world newly born from the primeval darkness, or sinking again into that from which it came. And then they were coming at me. There were four of them, walking their horses toward me, led by the same big young man who had led them below. "See," he was saying, "did I not know where to come? Did I not tell you?" The others divided, and slowly they surrounded me. My sword cane was in my hand. They knew it only as a stick, so let them learn if they would. At least one of them would die before I was killed. No use for me to run. On their fleet horses, on this almost level mountaintop, I would be an easy prey. Could I kill all four? "We have him now, and we shall have some sport of him."
"Why not take him below?" one asked, "and let the law have him."
"Don't be a child," the big one scoffed. "We will have him. The law can have what we leave of him." The youngest might have been no older than my 14 years, but the others were 2 to 4 years older. At least two of them were larger than I, and at least one was stronger. All were armed with sticks, at least two had daggers, and the large one a sword. If I escaped the circle and ducked back over the edge, where they were not likely to try and bring the horses, I might evade them for a time, or until those came who would take me to prison. For vagabonds had no rights that anyone recognized. To allow them to have their way and torture me was unthinkable. And during the more than 2 years I'd been dodging, evading, and hiding from the law, my mind had grown quick with stratagems. Their method was obvious. They would move in upon me, ringing me with their horses and themselves. And at any move I should make to escape, a horse would be put before me. I was trapped, and they knew it. Deliberately, I put my sword cane in my belt and spread my arms as if surrendering. The big one laughed. "See? He is a coward as well. He will not fight. Well, we will see." He thrust at me with his stick, and I dodged. He was too strong, much too strong. The others began to do likewise, and there was one who was astride a splendid sorrel gelding, a handsome horse, long-bodied and long-legged. He thrust at me, almost got me, then thrust again. A stick caught my ribs and ripped my shirt, tearing a thin scratch along my ribs. I felt the sting of it, but dodged again. Caught a short but ringing blow on my skull, and then the lad on the sorrel leaned far forward, thrusting at me. It was the moment for which I had waited. Instantly, I grasped the stick and jerked, hard. He was too far forward and off balance, and my jerk took him from the saddle. He fell, crying out, and as he hit the earth, I ducked under a blow, grasped the pommel, and swung myself to the empty saddle. Once again my horsemanship stood me in good stead, and the horse beneath me was quite the best of the lot. The big lad rode as good a horse, perhaps, but outweighed me by 50 or 60 pounds. I hit the saddle, clapped my heels to the horse's ribs, and took the sorrel away on a dead run. I had the start of them. Knowing what I planned to do gave me that start, and my mount had 3 good jumps before they realized, and another before they straightened out to run. And I fled into the open land beyond, toward the still distant sea. They came after me. Their angry shouts rang in my ears, and I heard the pound of hooves behind me. But the sorrel was a fine horse, and it loved to run. A glance back showed me I now led them by at least 5 lengths, and was gaining. They rode wildly, heedlessly, thoughtless of their mounts. I eased my speed a little, for I knew not how far I must go, and I chose the better ground. Hence, despite easing the speed, I held my lead, and darkness was close upon us. Once the dark came, I should have a chance. Glancing back again, I saw that one of them had fallen out of the race, for what reason I knew not. Lack of will, perhaps, for it had been easily seen that he who led them drove them as well. 2 only pursued me now, and one of those was falling back. On into the gathering dark I raced, straight toward the place where the sun had set, and now only 1 horse was pursuing. Suddenly, I know not what devil possessed me. I slowed my pace and swung my horse around to face him. He came thundering on, realizing too late that I had stopped, and as he pulled up hastily, I slapped heels to my sorrel and charged him. My mount hit his at the shoulder as he was reining in, and his horse staggered and went down. He was quick, ah, oh, so very quick. He leaped from the saddle as his horse fell and sprang at me. I reined my horse away and thrust at him with the sword cane, the blade still sheathed. It grazed the side of his head and staggered him, and I pivoted the horse and came at him again. He lunged at me, but I swung the horse away and drove my heel into the big lad's shoulder. It was a wrong move, for his hand grasped my leg, and the next I knew I was sprawling on the earth, and he was standing over me. "Ah," he said, "now we shall see." Having wrestled much, I did not try to escape, but threw my weight against his legs. It might as well have been against the side of a barn, for he gave not an inch, but stooped to grab me. Catching his sleeve, I jerked hard, and he fell forward. I was the more agile, and was out from under him, and on my feet. He came up swiftly, but I struck him hard in the face as he rose. It slowed him not at all, yet I hit him again before he was up, then leaped for my sword cane. He saw me pick it up, and drew his sword. We faced each other on the moors in the half-light. Already the stars were out. Yet we had been in the darkness, and each could see plainly enough. From the sheath I drew my blade. It was a small blade, as such sword cane blades are apt to be, shorter by inches than the usual sword. He had the reach of me anyway, by several inches. He whipped his blade this way and that, as if to show me he knew what he was about. I simply waited, trusting to my new skill to equal the reach he had. That I was good with a blade, I well knew. It had been obvious that in our last few weeks I had been forcing Corey to his limit. So I stepped forward willingly enough. High on the western moors of England, then, we fought by starlight. And within a matter of minutes, I knew I had met my master. It was not to be believed. Corey was good. All had said he was the best, and I was now as good. Yet, no sooner had we begun than I realized that this tall youth had skill beyond belief. Nor could I claim it was the length of his blade or his superior reach, for he was simply better. "Ah!" he exclaimed. "So you have fenced. What are you, then? Who are you?" "It does not matter," I said. "No," he agreed. "For when I have had my exercise, I shall kill you. I shall spit you like a goose." He handled himself with consummate skill. He was casual with me, not careless, for he could see I was better than most. He handled my best with indifference, and I knew that unless I could think of some trick, some means of subtlety, I would be dead within minutes. He was toying with me. Once he merely pricked my chest, when he might have killed me with a thrust. He simply smiled tauntingly and said, "Next time." Back, back. I fought carefully, sweat pouring down my cheeks, a cold sweat, for death was very near. How could he be so great when I had learned so much? It was unreal. Yet even though death was near, and I hated the man, I marvelled at his skill. Despite his great strength, he had the delicate touch of the master, and a strength in his wrist and fingers I could scarcely believe. Suddenly, I sensed a change in his blade, that most sensitive antenna reaching out to touch me. I sensed a change and knew. Now he would kill me. Now I would die. Was my life all for nothing then? My hopes gone? My dreams blasted? All my struggles for nothing? All the hopes of my father that I might found a family and let our blood march on down the centuries to come? Was this to be the end? Here on this dark moor by starlight? The ground slanted downward behind me. I found myself on a slight slope, which gave him the greater height, the greater advantage. What was happening? Where was I? There was no chance to look to right or left now. It was parry and thrust, and then suddenly I felt, rather than saw, a vast gulf opening behind me. His blade was up, poised for a thrust, and I threw myself back and down, falling backward, hoping to strike the turf and roll, to get away, to escape by any means. I fell, an impossible distance. My shoulders hit the ground with a thump, and I lost my grip on the sword cane, and it fell from me. I rolled over and tumbled, head over heels into a black, misty void. I tried to catch myself, but there was nothing on which to lay hold, and the slope was impossibly steep. I was falling, into what awful depth I knew not, but over and over I tumbled, until suddenly I was brought up with a sickening thud upon some rocks. How far had I fallen? Perhaps not more than 10 or 12 feet in that first sheer fall. But I must have tumbled down the rest of the slope, sliding, falling, tumbling again for 700 feet. A moment I lay still, surrounded by darkness and fog. Then, slowly, I rolled over and tried to push myself up, only to gasp with shock at my torn hands. I rolled to my knees and stood up. No bones were broken that I could feel, yet I hurt in every part of my body, and my hands were bloody, my face as well. I must escape. I must somehow get away. There was bound to be a way down, and they would come for me. Dumbly, hurt and shamed that I'd been so thoroughly beaten, I stumbled away into the mist. I could see nothing but the fog. There was heather around. I knew that because I brushed against it. I was on a moorland or something like. On and on I plodded, stupid with pain and weariness, knowing only that help, if any there was to be, lay far from here. I must get away before the morning light came again. I tripped and sprawled my length. For a moment I lay, as I was wishing only to stay there, even to die there. But something within me urged me up and on. Time and again I fell. Time and again I got up. Often I lay still for minutes, but always something drove me on. Finally, as day was breaking, I came upon a copse, choked with brush. Crawling into it, I lay still, more dead than alive. Yet the last thought with me as I lay there was, how could I have lost? How could he have been so much superior? A long time I slept, muttering in my half-sleep, crying out to some sore place touched the earth, until at last the cold dawn came and with it awakening, cold and wet. There had been the mist, and then the dew, perhaps. I shivered and tried to sit up. My muscles were stiff and heavy. My head was hard to hold up. My eyesight blurred as I stared about. Only the copse, the brush, the fallen leaves, a few broken branches. Groaning, I crawled out and stood cautiously up. Nothing was about. I was alone. Alone on a vast, wide, unknown land. Yet there was a smell in it of the sea. A smell from the westward. From among the broken branches, I found one that would do for a staff, and I started on. All the morning through, I walked. Clouds gathered. The sky was a sullen grey. Rain began to fall. On I went, staggering a little at times, but pushing on. To where? To a destiny somewhere, a destiny I must fulfil. At last I came to a stream, and on its banks I sat down. After resting, I bathed my face and bathed my bloody, gravel-torn hands. They were a fearful sight, and my face, too, from what I could see of it. Yet, gingerly, I washed that, too. Then I drank, and I drank again. Refreshed, I looked around. A few trees bordered the stream, nothing else. At last, fearfully hungry, I got to my feet. Stooping to pick up my staff, I almost fell again. I started downstream. For some inexplicable reason, I was heading for the sea. What awaited me there, I did not know, except that to me, it symbolized escape. At the sea began all things, and ended all things, perhaps. In which direction was I pointed? To another beginning, or to an end? I had no way of knowing. Nevertheless, I continued, because it was in me to go on, to persevere. So it was, and so my whole life long it would be. The stream wound onward, sometimes through low hills, sometimes higher ones, occasionally on the flat, but steadily it ran down slope, and somewhere ahead was the sea. Suddenly a voice. You there! What's wrong? Are you hurt? It took my eyes a moment to focus, for I'd taken a bad rap on the skull, and they functioned not at all well. It was a man in a cart. It would seem so, I said. I had a fall. Come along, then, he said. Climb in, and I shall take you where we can look. My faith, but you're bloody. Was it only a fall, then? Only a fall, I said. And a little hunger. Chapter 11. He gave me a long, careful look. You are but a lad, he said gently. Have you no home, then? I have none. What I once had is gone, and will not be again until I make it of myself. Where are you from? The question was not one I wished to answer, so I simply said I'd been going toward the sea, and had a bad fall in the darkness and the fog. When I described what I could of the place, he nodded and suggested, Near Hardnose Pass, I have no doubt. There is a rough, wild country, yon. The pony plodded steadily on. My cottage is but a little way along, the driver said, and you can stay the night if you are so minded. We can have a look at those hands, for they are in fearful shape. On and on we went, interminably, it seemed to me. I dozed, awoke, and dozed again. I was awakened by his pulling into the yard of a thatched cottage, a well-built place, with stables about, and some other animals. A man came from the stable. Ben, see to the pony. I will speak with you later. Staggering with weariness as I was, I hesitated. To stop here might be to be trapped, although I had come a goodly distance. I have far to go, I said, and must be getting on, although I am obliged for the ride you have given me. What is it? Are you pursued, then? It may be that I am, I said, although they be scoundrels who would pursue me. Yet I have no friends, and they have many. You have a friend in me, he said. Come in, lad. It was warm and pleasant within. A fire on the hearth, and a table set with trenchers for our eating. A woman stood looking at us. Her hair was fair with a tinge of red to it, and her cheeks were flushed from the fire. I heard your voices, and there's a plenty for both. Then she saw my face. Why, the lad is hurt. Come here to the fire, so we can see. She looked carefully at my skinned face and the bruises, and then put warm water in a basin, and with a bit of cloth, began to sponge off my face and take away the encrusted blood and gravel. After a bit she desisted, and cleaned my hands a bit more, although I had washed them in the Esk, for such was the name of the stream. Here, sit up and have a bite, then we'll get on with it. You must be fairly starved. I am that, I agreed. Where is it I am? The village yon is Boot, the man said. The hall yonder is empty now, for the family is from home to London. Most of them, he said with a wry glance at his wife. The gruel they served was good, and there was a bit of fish, fresh caught from the sea. When I have eaten, I told them, I had best be off, for I'd not bring trouble upon you. Briefly as I might, I explained how we'd been set upon, and what manner of folk they were. He filled a glass with ale. Aye, they're sons of the gentry, who raid and roust about with no care for anything but themselves. Worse than thieves they are, and brutal to all they can abuse. But do not worry, lad. You have come further than you think, and they will not come down on this side of the mountain. Be careful of him, I said, for bully that he is, he's also a rarely fine hand with a blade. From what you said, he was both taller and stronger than you, a man grown, and you but a lad. Aye, brute he may be, but I'll not take from him his skill. Height and reach are important. I could have handled them, but not his skill. The man from whom I learned was considered among the best. Yes, I had no chance. Rafe Leckenby, the woman said. There is no other fits the description.
Leckenby? Aye, it could be. He's a bad enemy, lad, and a worse man. He comes not here, but stays there where his family is important. But he has killed a man or two, and it is said he will be off to the wars soon, for they wish to be rid of him, I think.
There I spent the night, and the weariness fled from my muscles. When the morning came, I was refreshed, yet weary still, for I had been long in fleeing, and long without food.
"Where will you go?" Andrew asked, for that was his name, and hers was Mary. But their other names I never heard, neither then nor after.
I would go to London, but I am far from there. If I could find some fisherman, some boat that plies to Scotland, I would go there and be free of this place.
These are bad times, and no high road is safe. Men's goods are seized, and often as not by gentry. And there is no appeal. The times are bitter, and he is at his wits' end who must live upon the roads, for there are none there but peddlers, herbalists, mountebanks, and jugglers, mingling with thieves and outlaws. No man is safe upon the road unless with a large company and all armed.
But it grows better, Mary protested. I have heard you say as much yourself.
Aye, better, but not better enough. There is much to be done before the roads are safe for travel.
Andrew glanced at me.
How old are you?
14 years.
14? And you have seen so much, and already a swordsman.
But not good enough. I must go where I can learn more.
Italy, then? Or Spain? Although they do say the French are excellent swordsmen.
He studied me.
Are you then so anxious to fight?
That I am not. But my father warned me I would have enemies, and to survive I must be prepared. I hope never to fight, I added in all sincerity. But experience has taught me that wishing to avoid a fight will not always be enough.
It is all very well to wish for peace, but while there are such people as this Rafe Leckenby, there will always be wars. A man can convince himself that others want peace as much as he, but he will only be fooling himself, for it is the last thing many men want, unless they can take all they covet without having to fight.
We talked long. He was a man keenly aware of conditions in his country, although I could not place his role. He had a goodly farm here, but did not seem a farmer. Albeit most of the farmers were of the gentry, and some owned vast estates. That he was curious about me I knew. Yet the long months upon the high roads had taken much of my accent, and I had picked up words or phrases here and there. Corey, especially, had taught me a lot, other than what I had learned of the blade.
"You have read much," Andrew said, finally, putting down his glass. "Your father was your teacher," you said.
"He was a fine classical scholar," I said. "But he taught me much else besides. Along the roads," I added, "I have learned much of herbs and their uses."
"Aye, learn what you can. There is naught that will not but be useful."
He was a friendly man, a gentleman, obviously, and, if I was not mistaken, of the nobility. There were many such who had a living but little else. Younger sons, or those who inherited impoverished estates, or none at all. Even the King of Scotland had to borrow a coat from a friend to wear before a visiting ambassador. The possession of a great name did not always mean great wealth, and indeed, the visit of a king and his entourage might be sufficient to impoverish even a well-off man. From the way he referred to the hall, I suspected he was a younger son or a cousin, perhaps. The house was a good one and old, of squared grey stone and stout oak timbers. The cobbled passage down which we had come opened into the living room, where we now were. The kitchen was beyond the passage, and I had only a glimpse of the huge fireplace as we entered. There was little furniture, and that quite heavy. We talked of Green and Philip Sidney, of Chaucer and of Tacitus and Livy. Yet I listened more than I talked, for much as it reminded me of home, weariness lay heavy upon me. And it was his good wife who called Andrew's attention to my worn-out state, and soon I was off to bed, in a small chamber of my own. Worried as I was, I soon fell asleep. My eyes opened suddenly, and for a time I lay still, trying to recall all that had transpired. At last I arose. There was water in the room, hot water. Evidently, whoever brought it had awakened me. Yet it left before my eyes opened, or I became aware. I bathed, combed my hair, and made myself as presentable as might be. As I bathed and prepared myself, I thought over my fight with Leckenby, if such indeed was his name. My memory for such things had always been good, and now I reviewed that fight in detail. His reach had helped him, and his longer, stronger blade. Yet he had skill of a rare kind, and a genius, I thought, for the sword. Yet such genius breeds confidence, and confidence may well become overconfidence, if fed by continual success. Mentally, I reviewed his moves, trying to discern a pattern that might be circumvented. I began to see that he'd been surprised by my skill. Again and again, I had warded off his most serious attacks, even though most of the time he was simply enjoying his command of me. He had won, and he would surely have killed me, but still I had come off not badly. "All right," I said aloud. "He beat me once, but he will not beat me a second time." Very well to say such a thing, but before I could meet him, I needed to learn much more. There was a shout from outside. Opening my door, I went down the stair. The front door stood open, and Andrew was before it. In the yard were at least 20 horsemen, led by Ralph Leckenby. "We want him," Leckenby was saying, "and we will have him." "I think not," Andrew said quietly. "Think what you do, Leckenby. I know your father well, and he would not permit such a scene as this." "Give him up," Leckenby replied, "or we will take him." Mary went around me and pressed something into her husband's hand. It was a pistol. "I will go with Leckenby," I said to my host. "I will not be the cause of trouble for you, who have been so kind." Andrew glanced at me. "This is no longer your affair," he replied. "They have come here, onto our land, to use force and make demands. I would not permit you to leave now." "You have heard me," Leckenby said. "I will have your house down around your ears, but I will have him." Coolly, Andrew brought his pistol from behind his back, and at the same time there was a rustle of feet. Glancing to my right, I saw a half-dozen men armed with pikes, scythes, and halberds. Two men suddenly appeared on the stable roof, both with bows and arrows ready. "You may try," Andrew said quietly, "but you will die. Also," he smiled a little, "you have yet to get yourselves home. I am considered a mild man. My brother is not, and he will be here this day. I think you will be fortunate if you get home at all." There was a murmur from behind him. Already some of those who followed Leckenby were backing off. I believe most of them followed him only from fear of what he might do if they did not. Although, undoubtedly, some were as much the rogue as he himself. "Ralph?" It was the same one who had advised letting up on me. "There's always another time." Leckenby hesitated, but he liked not the pistol nor the firm resolution of Andrew. He turned his mount. "We will come again," he threatened. Then he looked at me. "And you? I will slit your gullet in my own good time." "You will not have to come looking, Leckenby," I said, "for I shall be back to find you, I have thought over our bout of yesterday, and now I know I can beat you. Ha! He laughed unpleasantly. The man does not live who can best me, least of all you. Of course, I had boasted when I said I had thought over his actions, and knew I could now best him. I knew certainly I could do nothing of the kind, but I also knew that in time I should. I would study, learn, work much with the blade, and then I would seek him out. They rode away, and 24 of Andrew's men mounted and followed at a short distance to see them gone. Several of them looked to be stout fighting men who had served in the Queen's forces by land or sea. I doubted not they could take care of themselves against the rabble who followed Leconby. "I must get on my way now," I said. "You have been kind, but I have far to go." "Indeed you have, lad." Andrew put a hand on my shoulder. "But I'd forget your promise to come and find Ralph Leconby. He's an evil one, and time will take care of his kind." "We shall see." I paused. "I wish to make for Scotland now. Which is the best way?" "There are fishing boats at the Esk that go north up the coast. But if I mistake not, Leconby will expect you there. So I would suggest you go north on land. I will see you on your way. I have friends at Workington Hall." "I know the name." "Aye. A few years back, Mary Queen of Scots took refuge there. Perhaps we can find a letter for you that will open a way for you among the Scots. You are too kind." "If you wished to stay, we could make a place for you here. You are a good lad, and should not be wandering about the country like any gypsy or vagabond." "I have a way to go," I said. "Aye," he replied gloomily. "One I might have taken myself at your age. But then I met Mary." "You did well," I said, "as did she." He smiled. "Aye. Now we will have up some horses and ride north. You do not fear to leave after all this?" He chuckled grimly. "If they wish to return, let them do so. My lads will be about, and they are a rough lot. My father had a ship and was often at sea. Many of these men here sailed with him. They have endured many a hard-fought battle. You'll not find their like this side of the Highland clans." He was a careful man, and north we rode by starlight, that we might not be observed from afar. At dawn we rested, and ate at a drover's cot, a cosy, hidden place, among the grey rocks and green rolling hills, where a burn came down from the rocky hills, chuckling and babbling through the green hummocks and among wildflowers. A pleasant land, but a waiting land too, for often had fierce Highland raiders come this way. At Workington, Andrew found a fisherman he knew, a Scot by the name of Jamie, and fresh down from the West Highlands. "Aye, I will take him away, and gladly." Jamie looked at my face and hands. "You've had a rough go of it, lad. What is it you wish for now?" "To be well again, and to find a fine swordsman who can teach me." "And then?" "Then I shall return." "There speaks a true man. Well, he used you hardly, but not with a sword, I'll mind." "A sword as was. This is but from a fall I had, although thankful I was to fall, for it saved my life. A moment more, and he would have had me."
"Was he so good, then?"
"The best."
"Aye. Wait until you've met MacCaskill, lad. He's one of a fighting lot. Lead the MacLeods in battle, they do. And a brawny, fearsome lot they are. But the one to whom I'll take you, he's another matter. For he has served in armies abroad, and is a terrible man in a fight. If he can teach me, I will go to him."
"If he will teach you."
"I doubt he will. He's a man of independent mind and thought. He teaches no one."
"But he could."
"You are a brawny lad, surely, and we'll take you along to him. He can do no more than say no."
And who is the man?
Fergus MacCaskill. He's fought in the clan wars in the Highlands, but upon the continent as well. 'Tis not only the claymore for which he's known, but every kind of a weapon.
The MacCaskills are to be found on the Isle of Lewis in the Hebrides, and some perhaps on Skye. I've not been there myself, but they are allied to the MacLeods, and have the name of strong fighters, always.
Andrew added that comment, and then arose.
I'll leave him to you, Jamie, and do you see him well ashore, for he seems a good lad, and I'd like as much done for me, was I left as he is.
I am obliged, I told him. You shall see me again one day.
Jamie led the way down to his boat.
Have you been upon the sea, then?
A time or two, and far from here. But upon water not unlike this.
Good. You can help me, then, for it looks to be a braw bad night upon the water.
And a braw bad night it was, to be sure. The wind howled down the firth, as if to bury us by its sheer force, and a driving rain with it. When I came ashore at last, there was not a dry stitch to me, but I was in Scotland, and free of my enemies. And there was a man for me to find, the great fighting man, Fergus MacCaskill. Tomorrow, with dry clothes, a night's sleep, and a meal under my belt, I would begin.
Chapter 12.
Alone upon the shore, I watched the fisher's boat turn to take the wind, and lifted a hand to bid farewell. I did not know if he saw me, but I stood and watched him go, then turned to walk up the path. I was in Galloway, with nothing in my hands and no place to go. Yet a man must move, and I have discovered it is always best to keep putting one foot before the other, and so I did now. A gloomy, foggy, mysterious place it was, and a fit one for the seeing of ghosties and ghoulies in the night. Boylike, I was wary of such creatures, wanting none of them. After walking a bit, I saw a light, but when I knocked upon the door, no answer came, and the light went out. Although I waited and knocked again, there was no opening of the door, nor any welcome. A mile or more beyond, I saw a cluster of lights. One belonged to a place that passed for a tavern, for as I came near, a man emerged, weaving somewhat from the cargo he carried, which was shifting him about like a heavy sea. I hailed him, and asked if there might be shelter for the night, and a bite of something.
"Aye!"
The man swayed like a willow in the wind.
"And good food it is, too, if you're of a mind to eat. But his ale's the better bargain. Sure, and I think the man is heir to that Pict, who is said to have jumped from the cliffs yonder o' the Mull, holding the formula for heather ale."
"I'll speak to him then," I said, and went to the door and opened it. The room was low of ceiling, heavily timbered, and there was a huge old fireplace with copper kettles and such, and a few benches about, and a long table at which some men sat, boatmen, fishermen, and the like, each with his mug of ale before him.
"Way, it's a lad, and a sorry wet one too. Come in now, up to the fire with ye."
The speaker was a wide man and deep, with reddish whiskers at his jowls, and a queer sort of flat cap to his head.
"John, a bit of something for the lad now."
"What'll you have, boy?"
The innkeeper was a fat, pleasant-looking man.
"Whatever," I said. "I've little enough money."
"Do you not be thinking of that? I've a son mysel."
The man with the red whiskers clapped me on the shoulder.
"Sit close to the fire, lad, and drink up. A drop will do you no harm this e'en."
When I had the glass in my hand and a plate of bread and gruel before me, I said, "Can you be telling me now where I'm likely to find Fergus MacCaskill?" They stared at me, and my friend put his glass down hard upon the table.
"Fergus, is it?"
"Aye.
There'll be a plenty would like to see Fergus, but there's many more would wish for no sight of him."
He drank and wiped the back of his hand across his mouth.
Why would a lad like you be wanting to find Fergus?
I do not know him, nor him me. Yet it has been said that he is a great fighting man, and I would learn.
To fight? A man can fight, or he cannot. 'Tis all.
Nah, John, you know that isn't true, what you say. A man may have the heart, but know the skill. Cannot you see? The lad wants the skill. He wishes to learn.
Why then?
So I told it simply, how I fancied myself a swordsman, although I was only a boy, and how those who set upon me proved my skill was nothing like enough.
And when you've the skill, what then?
I shall go back. I shall find Ralph Leckenby again. I shall make him show me his best, and then I shall beat him.
Ha! Well, I'll be thinking you'll have to talk your best to get aught from Fergus. He's no the one to teach any who come, only those who seek him out for a fight, and they pay dear for what they get.
Where to look? That's the question, I said. The men exchanged glances.
Go north and ask for him.
If he wishes to see you, he'll find you soon enough. And if he doesn't, you will be whistling to the wind for all you'll see of him. My gruel was hearty enough, and warmed my insides. The ale was good, and soon the chill began to go from me.
Do you have the Gaelic, then?
He who was my friend put the question.
Aye.
Although a different sound than yours, no doubt.
But I have it, never fear.
You will need it. There some say he takes notions time to time, and will speak only that.
One man got up. It be late. I've a fair piece to go.
He went out, shutting the door behind him. My lids were heavy, and I nodded above the last of my ale.
John, the lad's dying for sleep.
Can you not put him down before the fire? He's not the paling kind, I'll warrant.
I am not, I said. I would steal from no man.
There's a bit of rug by the fire, lad, if you can make do with it.
I could sleep on a stone, I said,
and think it soft.
That tired I am.
I crossed the Solway this night from England, and travelled some before that.
And hurt, too.
John indicated my face. But it heals. The man who spoke for me helped to move back the table, and they unrolled their bit of rug before the fire. He may do upon a bench, but I trusted no such place for fear of falling off in the night.
John added a chunk or two to the fire,
driftwood, brought up from the sea it was, looking like a bit of some great spar from a lost ship. I said as much.
Aye, a few have been lost yonder, off the Mull. Some fine vessels, too, and some fine folks.
John left us then for his own bed. The candle was snuffed, and only the firelight lit the room. And all was still enough, except for a drop now and again, as rain fell into the fire. It hissed at each drop, and sometimes a spark flew. The room was warm, but tired though I was, I could scarcely sleep. Suddenly the man upon the bench spoke with a whisper.
"Lad, be you awake, still?"
"Aye," I said, not trusting him, although friendly enough he had been.
"Lad, if you'll come along with me when morning comes, I'll show you on your way, and more. I'll pay you a bit. I need a sturdy lad who's not afeard to fight."
"Fight? I have no wish for it. Only in my own good time, and with those I choose."
"Lad, lad, do you think I ken not your Gaelic? You're Irish as Paddy's pig, and so am I. But there's those who would have my heart if the chance offered."
"Here? In Scotland?"
"Aye, even here. I need other eyes to watch, and you've a smart way about you."
He paused. "Who are you, then?"
"I did not ask you," I said.
"That you did not. So be it. My way is your way, lad. I've a man to see in the Highlands, a man who is friendly to the Irish. But there's English spies about. Mind you, I find no harm in the Englishmen. I've friends among them, but they're Queen's men. Aye, that's another thing. I go to the Highlands, and I seek Fergus MacCaskill. If my way lies with yours, so be it. Good then. They look for a man alone. Together, we've a chance, and we can take turns sleeping. And tonight? No, I think tonight is safe, but if you hear a sound outside, touch my foot. I'll come awake soon enough. The wind was rising and the rain increasing. I liked it not, and wished to travel alone, yet a fellow Irishman. A man seeking help for Ireland, no doubt. Well, I would see what the next day offered, and take each day as it came. I wanted no fight with any man except Leckenby, and that only in its time. I slept, awakening only to stir the fire and to listen to the hard rain fall and the wind. It was an angry sea, yon, and I knew why he who brought me turned so quick from the shore, for he smelled it on the wind. He knew the storm was coming. What was it the old wives say? God have pity on the poor sailors on such a night as this. Aye, and all who had no shelter, as I might not have had. Grey was scarcely in the sky before my companion was up and outside, looking about at the weather. John handed me a bowl of hot soup. Drink it, lad. You travel a great distance, and I wish you luck. A movement of his head indicated the man outside. You walk with him. I shrugged. It was spoken of. For a distance, perhaps. He is a good man, make no mistake, but he walks a dangerous path. All who are with him are in danger, for what he does is close upon treason. If anybody could find Fergus MacCaskill for you, he could. But do not become involved with what he does, and if danger comes, think of yourself and get away. He would wish that too. He paused. Breaking a chunk of bread from a loaf, he handed it to me. My mother was from Ireland, so I've a sympathy for them there. Be careful, lad. We walked away in the morning upon a winding road across the moors, and in all the wide land we saw no others but ourselves, save here or there some sheep, and once a cow. Ahead lies Glentrul, my companion said. It is a dark and bitter land, yet with rare beauty, and stories. Ah, the stories it could tell! Murder and mystery and old things found. Spearheads pushing up from the soil after a rain. And once I came upon a length of ancient sword while hiding in the trees there. It is a place to lose a man if he wishes to be lost. Or a body if the killer wishes to make no explanation. There are thieves and outlaws hiding there too. And not afar was where Robert the Bruce won a victory over his pursuers. A small victory, but a victory. He looked at me. What do they call you, lad? They call me Tat. It is enough. What they call me is another thing. But for the time, I am a Scotsman, Angus Fair. I am a seafaring man, returning from a long time at sea. He paused, turning to look back the way we had come. You know nothing of me, lad, if questioned. Simply say honestly enough that we just met, and you understood I was returning home after 20 years at sea. He smiled. That allows for me having no connection, no land, and only a destination. My family have all passed on, but I've a wish in me to see the place where I was a boy before going back to the seas again. And I have a wish to get on with it, for I have a feeling the Spanish will be mounting an attack upon us. Now you know my story, and as for you, I am helping you to go to relatives in the Highlands. Does it please you, this story? Aye, and why not? It answers questions simply enough. One thing more, lad. There are those about who are no lovers of the Irish. So if I were you, I'd be the son of a Scottish soldier who was killed in Ireland, fighting for the Queen, and you were raised there. Now you are returning to your own. We walked on into the morning, and Angus Phair talked of Ireland, repeating some of the tales I'd had first from my father.
Ah, lad, the trouble with the Irish is that they fight best when fighting for others, and among themselves there is no common cause, no unity. In all the lands of Europe you will find Irishmen, often in command, and always fighting well, while their own poor country is occupied by the British. Mind you, lad, I am not a hater as some are, but a patriot, a lover of his own land. I wish for its freedom, but do not blind myself to its faults. If the British would stay in their own land, we'd love them well, for we've much in common, but freedom we must have. How we will use it? Ah, 'tis another question, lad, another question.
As we walked, he rambled on, talking of many things, and I listened, having much to learn. He was a man who had travelled, had known many kinds of men under all sorts of conditions. The clouds were low and grey, heavy with rain. About us, the grass was a deep, deep green, and the distant mountains were sombre. We walked steadily on, each with a stout staff, for easier walking. Twice we passed farmsteads not far off the road, houses of grey stone walls and thatched roofs. Once a big dog stood watching us until we were safely by, but it did not bark. Soon we saw no more people, no dogs, no distant houses, but only the stark and empty grassland, and then the forest. It was a lonely land, and we talked not at all, each alert, for we knew not what. Out here, a man seemed to stand out, and there seemed no place to hide. "Yet there is," Angus replied. "You have simply always to be alert. You and me, we must never forget that. So look about you. There are low places in the ground, rocks and sometimes clumps of heather. The thing to remember is to lie still. Movement draws the eye." And I did look, and from time to time did see places where a man might hide, if he lay still. Now the land took on a wilder aspect, and there was almost continual rain. It was with relief that we saw a cluster of houses before us, and smoke rising from several of them. "There's a bit of an inn," Angus Phair said. "If the weather were not so gloomy, I'd say to pass on. But we'll stop. A warm meal will do us well." He lifted the latch and swung open the door, and we stepped in. As we shook off the rain and looked up, we knew we had done the wrong thing. There were 5 men in the room, 3 of them armed like soldiers. It was too late to draw back. To return to the night in such weather was enough to arouse suspicion of us.
"'Tis a heavy dew," Angus commented. "A good night for a draught of ale and a warm fire."
They did not smile, but simply stared at us, nothing friendly in their eyes.
Chapter 13.
There was no place by the fire, so we went to a rough board table and sat down on benches that faced it on either side. Angus pulled his bench around, so he could sit with his back toward the wall and his face to the door. I sat around the corner of the table from him, facing the fire and the men who sat before it. It was a good blaze, but there was chill at our backs, and not from the cold only. This was a wild land where we now were, and few were the travellers who ventured to cross it. There were outlaws in the forest or lurking in the glens for unwary travellers, but these were not such. Mine host brought us a slab of meat, good venison too. Along with it, he brought a loaf, and then he drew 2 mugs of ale. The inn, if such it might be called, was ancient. The stone-flagged floor underfoot was worn and polished by much use, and a corner of the wall was old, too. Someone at a much later date had added the rest. Angus stamped a foot on the floor.
"Old," he said.
"Aye,